been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.
Good morning, Ramona Cobbell here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today I'll be joined by Helen Garner speaking about her new novel, The Spare Room, in which we follow what happens when Nicola, a beloved old friend dying of cancer, comes to stay for 3 weeks with a woman called Helen to take part in what Helen regards as shonky alternative therapies. It's a story that explores compassion and willfulness and finding one's best self. And we're continuing our first-person reading of Christopher Kremer's The Carpet Wars. Helen Garner's award-winning books include novels and short stories and screenplays and works of non-fiction like The First Stone and Joe Cinque's Consolation. Her new book is The Spare Room, her first novel in 15 years. Helen Garner, welcome to The Book Show.
Thanks, Ramona.
Let's begin by the very looking at the book at the very beginning, and I want you to read to us from the beginning of your novel.
Okay. First, in my spare room, I swiveled the bed onto a north-south axis. Isn't that supposed to align the sleeper with the planet's positive energy flow or something? She would think so. I made it up nicely with a fresh fitted sheet, the pale pink one, since she had a famous feel for colour, and pink is flattering even to skin that has turned yellowish. Would she like a flat pillow or a bulky one? Was she allergic to feathers, or even as a vegetarian opposed to their use? I would offer choice. I rounded up all the extra pillows in the house, slid each one into a crisply ironed slip, and plumped them in a row across the head of the bed. I pulled up the wooden Venetian and threw open the window. Air drifted in, smelling leafy, though you couldn't see a leaf unless you forced open the flywire screen and leaned right out. She had been staying for months with her niece Iris on the 8th floor of an Art Deco apartment block in Elizabeth Bay, whose windows, I imagined, pointed due north over a canopy of massive Sydney figs towards the blue field of the harbour. The immediate view from my spare room, until I could get some geraniums happening in a window box, was of the old grey paling fence that separated my place from my daughter Eva's. The sash window faced east, though, and the light bouncing off the weatherboard side of Eva's house kept the room bright till well into the afternoon. Also, it was late October, which in Melbourne is supposed to be spring. I was worrying about her feet. The floor of her room was bare timber, except for a worn keelum full of rips. What if she snagged one of her long, elegant toes in it? What if she fell? Slippers were among the things she didn't bother with, along with suitcases, bras, deodorants, irons. I rolled up the dangerous keelum and threw it into the back shed. Then I drove over to a shop opposite Piedamonte Supermarket, where my friend Peggy, who knows about these things, said they sold tribal rugs. Straight away I spotted a pretty one, blossoms of watery green and salmon twining on a mushroom ground. The bloke told me it was Iranian, vegetable dyed. I chose it because it was faded. She would hate me to buy anything specially, to make a fuss. Would she want to look at herself? It was months since I had last laid eyes on her. All I knew was from our emails. Every time the news sounded bad under her chirpy chatter, I would suggest flying up to Sydney, but she put me off. She was going out to dinner and couldn't change the date, or there wouldn't be a bed for me, or she didn't want me to waste my money. She might take it the wrong way if her room lacked a mirror. Behind the bookshelf in my workroom, I found one I'd bought in an Asian import shop at Berkeley Square and never used, a tall, narrow, unframed rectangle of glass, its back still equipped, top and bottom, with strips of double-sided adhesive tape. I selected a discreet spot for it, just inside the door of her room, and pressed it firmly against the plaster. On the bedside table, I fanned out some chord charts to have a crack at on our ukuleles, Pretty Baby, Don't Fence Me In, King of the Road. I arranged the reading lamp on a gracious angle and placed beside it a mug full of nameless greenery that I'd found near the back shed. Then I went along the corridor to my room at the front of the house and lay on the bed with my boots on. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. What woke me 10 minutes later was a horrible two-stage smash, so sickening, so total, that I thought someone had thrown a brick through the side window. I rushed out all trembly and ran along the hall. Nothing moved. The house was quiet. I must have dreamt it. But the edge of the old hall runner, halfway to the kitchen, was weirdly sparkling. I stepped over it and into the spare room. The mirror no longer existed. The wall was bare, and the Iranian rug was thick with the glitter of broken glass. I swept with the dustpan and brush. I beat with the millet broom. I hoovered in cunning, angled strokes. The fragments of mirror were mean-shaped and stubborn, some so minuscule that they were only chips of light. They hid against the rug's scalp, in the roots of its fur. I got down on my knees and picked them out with my fingernails. When the daylight faded and I had to stop, my sister Connie rang me. A mirror broke? In her room? I was silent. Then she said in a low, urgent voice, "Don't tell Nicola."
Helen Garner reading from the opening of The Spare Room. And you're on The Book Show on Radio National. That is the best description of a shattered glass on the rug and the cleaning up of it and the sort of worry that it's going to get into someone's foot that I've ever read.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever read one. I mean, you've ever read, honey. it's a great attention to detail.
Well, there is something awful, particularly and especially awful about broken glass, isn't there? Especially when you think of children's fat little feet.
Yeah. And the broken mirror, of course, the bad luck.
Mm. 7 years of it, touch wood.
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone listening to that can sort of feel that something's going to happen from that opening. All the hairs on the backs of our necks are up now. And it starts off, is that what you want?
Well, I wanted it to work that way, yeah.
Starts off with the clean pillows and the and the Manchester.
Mm.
Tell me about making a bed.
Making a bed. Well, it's one of life's more enjoyable tasks, I think. It's there's something about cotton that's very pleasing to human skin, and I like them. A friend of mine who's a psychotherapist once said to me, I said to her how I loved going to bed at night. It was my favourite moment. I'm talking about solo sleeping here. And she said, "Oh, bed is mother." And I thought that was a very enlightening remark, because there's something enfolding and enclosing and clean and welcoming and restful about a bed. So it's also the place where you go to retire, as it were, from the active part of life. You're allowed to become passive in a bed, and it's the sort of trapdoor into which you let yourself down into sleep and dreams. It's I suppose in that sense you could call it what they call a liminal space. It's on the threshold.
It's on the threshold of something. Making a bed for somebody else, though, you use a quote from Elizabeth Jolly.
Mm.
"It is a privilege to prepare the place where someone else will sleep."
Mm. I love that. I first found that line of hers when I was writing a piece about her work a good 20 years ago, and I was so struck by it. It stayed in my mind ever since. And it seemed, well, like a lot of things that Elizabeth Jolly said, it seems to take the tiny tasks of daily life and make something rich out of them. She seemed to have this wonderful way of connecting humble daily tasks with very deep meanings. And so when I always knew that I was going to be able to use that as an epigraph when I wanted to write this book, so I did, and I'm glad.
This Helen in this book plumps the pillows and makes everything nice and It's almost like she's sort of setting up a bed and breakfast, as it were. You know, the sort of things you want when you go and stay at someone's house, and just the little touches.
Mm.
It turns out that she's letting herself in for more than she perhaps bargained for.
Mm.
There is something about feeling good about yourself, about being a good hostess, isn't there? About making getting the spare room ready.
Yes, there's sort of a sort of a vanity in it, really, and I wanted that sort of runs through the book. If there's a little thin thread of that running through the book, where the Helen in the book, and I'm going to refer to her constantly as Helen.
That's her name, of course.
That's her name. She is a bit vain about her fantasy of herself as someone who can provide a resting place for someone. She says, I was supposed to be good in a crisis. She's thinks that she's the kind of person who can deal with what she's about to cop, but she finds out that she can't. I mean, in a way, that's what the book's about.
But she gives us a few clues because she says things like she's putting the pale pink sheet on since the friend of hers, Nicholas, had a famous feel for colour, and pink is flattering even to skin that it's turned yellowish. Now, that's the first paragraph, and there's a pretty hard cold eye there at the beginning, you know.
Oh yeah, and where do you see the cold eye you read that out? Do you mean about
the skin,
her yellow
that had
skin
turned yellowish? Mm.
Well, I wanted the reader to know immediately that this is a sick person coming, and I didn't want to start off by saying this person has cancer. Yeah, I thought, okay, well, everybody knows what yellow skin means. It probably means you've had chemo. So I just wanted the sort of awfulness of her predicament to kind of, I wanted to drop it in little tiny drops rather than whack it down.
Is the swivelling the bed on the north-south axis, isn't that supposed to align the sleeper with the planet's positive energy flow or something? There's a kind of, it's like, oh, well, you know, my old friend who's coming and she's a bit of a, she's a bit funny.
Bit of a hippie.
Yeah.
But then, you know, that right through the book there's also a sense that, well, I hope there is, of how both these women have lived through a period of history where all sorts of wacky ideas were considered to be quite attractive and according to which they arranged their domestic lives, perhaps. I mean, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea whether there is such a thing as a positive energy flow on the planet, but it's a sort of a lovely idea. So when people said to me back in the 70s, oh, all beds should always run north and south for that reason, whenever I'm putting a bed in the room, I think, okay, I better put it north and south. But I don't.
To think about all the beds.
But I actually, you know, the bed I sleep in at the moment runs east and, well, I'd say west-northwest. Yeah, but those ideas are these women belong to a generation where the outer edge of which was hippiness, and even Helen, who fancies herself as rational, is as it were captive of lots of crazy ideas.
Well, Helen, of course, meets Nicola, and Nicola's actually in a much worse shape than she thought. She's really sick. In fact, she's got stage 4 cancer, and in fact there are only 4 stages, so she's on her way out. And Nicola has decided that she's got to go to this place called the Theodore Institute. She's going to be fine by next week, apparently.
Mm. Yeah, by the middle of next week they'll have it on the run.
On the run. Mm. And so we meet this character and we think, well, you know, what do we do with someone like this who's coming to stay in your house? But Helen is very good. She takes Nicola to the Theodore Institute. And I wanted you to read a little bit about what she finds at the Theodore Institute, because this is some kind of, is it a doctor? Is it not a doctor? It's some kind of alternative clinic. And they're doing things like giving huge amounts of vitamin C or doing hocus pocus businesses. Why don't you read this little bit? And we're listening to Helen Garner reading from her new novel, The Spare Room, on ABC Radio National, and you're on The Book Show.
Well, this is I'm going to go into the middle of a scene where the first visit they make to this clinic, and they've been at this point waiting 4 hours for their appointment. I believe this is quite common in certain types of alternative clinics. But so Nicola is supposed to have been seen at 4, and around about now it's about 8 o'clock, and instead of seeing her, giving her a consultation. The doctor comes out and says he's going to give a presentation. There are various other people in the waiting room. The doctor set up a screen against a wall, opened a laptop on the counter, and stood resting one elbow beside it. Without having to be asked, we shuffled our chairs into better viewing positions. Somebody sighed. He pressed the first key and up came the title of his talk, Cancer and Its Treatments. If you're looking at the text, you see that it's is spelled IT apostrophe S. I didn't dare look at Nicola, not because she would laugh at the apostrophe, but because I was afraid she wouldn't. I'm going to tell you, Dr. Tuckey began, about our key cancer-killing therapies. You know how an octopus can break a big rock with its tentacles? Well, that's what a cancer cell's like. Did he mean the cell was like the octopus or the rock? The doctor's manner as he worked his way down the dot points was modest and amiable, almost soothing. Everything about him was spongy, without defence. You could not hate him. But his discourse had a stupefying effect. My mind veered about, seeking something to grip. I was tired, I was hungry. My concentration waxed and waned. Once or twice I nodded off. This was not the moment to zone out. I pushed my chair back a few feet and sneaked the notebook and pen out of my bag. Stress, he said, is the biggest cause of cancer in our society. Stress makes us vulnerable to whatever nasties we have lurking in our beings. Well, that wasn't so outlandish. My thoughts coasted sideways to my sister Madeline, her relentless grief and rage when her husband drowned in the surf, how she wielded without mercy the manipulative power of her suffering. 10 years later, an untreatable cancer was found in her lung. She accepted her death sentence quietly, without mutiny. Perhaps, we thought in awe, she even welcomed it. She laid down her gun. She let us cherish her. We nursed her. In less than a year, with her family near her, she put aside her knitting and died in her own house, in the bed she had shared with her husband. While outside the window, the shapely limbs of the trees they had planted together stood leafless in the late winter air. If people are struck by lightning and survive, the doctor was saying, their cancers shrink and disappear. I glanced at the other listeners. No one else seemed to find this strange. A fissure in the earth under your house can disturb the electromagnetic field. In Germany, quite a high percentage of cancer victims are living over one of these. A fissure? Didn't I read about that in the 70s? People whose living room floor collapsed into a disused mine shaft, whose grand piano slid into the chasm and vanished forever, and on top of that they got cancer? Nicola's head was cocked in a posture of intent listening. The incidence, says the doctor, of certain sorts of cancer is known to be much lower around the equator. This is good, solid research published just a few months ago. Now I was wide awake. High-dosage vitamin C, he said, will kill off lumps of cancer and boost the immune system. And our ozone sauna treatment is based on the old natural therapy approach to cancer, sweating out the toxins. Most doctors don't know this stuff, but it's good science. Nicola sat chin in hand, her handsome face suffused with an expression of deep pleasantness, offering the doctor generous eye contact and nodding, nodding, always nodding. Vin from Broken Hill laid his hand on his wife's legs, which were now resting across his lap. His tenderness moved something painful in me. It rebuked me in my suspicion and contempt. What did I know about cancer? Maybe there was something in these cockamamie theories. Maybe they were the future. Maybe Leo was wrong when he stated that vitamin C did not shrink tumours. Maybe it was unfair that these pioneers had fallen foul of the authorities and were obliged to treat their patients in shabby private clinics. But I couldn't help sneaking looks at the loose swag of flesh that overlapped the waistband of Dr. Tuckey's trousers. His shirt buttons divided it into a double burden. It did not appear to be meaningfully attached to his frame. It swayed half a beat behind his movements. It trembled. It hung, a shapeless cargo of meat.
Oh, how brilliant to put the shapeless cargo of meat in juxtaposition with that. I mean, that's the art of the novelist, isn't it? To put things like that together, although shattered glass and the making the bed and just the resonances.
Well, I always like to work with the material world a lot. I've never been much good at sort of thinking abstractly or arguing abstractly. I don't feel comfortable unless I've got a lot of objects on the page. And they seem to do an awful lot of work if you can arrange them into the right configuration. They sort of carry a huge amount of energy and meaning. And it's just a matter of respecting them, really. And
in what way respecting them?
I mean, letting them do their work. Perhaps you have to have done a lot of inner work yourself for that to...
Inner work, like thinking about why you think the way you do?
No, I think I mean practice. I think I mean practice. Yeah, that's what I mean. Because, you see, for as long as I can remember, I've written something. I've written every day for at least an hour or so. And, I mean, what I've written, it's called a diary, I suppose. But a lot of it is just, a lot of it is practice. And I, whenever I'm teaching writing, which I occasionally do, I try to stress this to people, that you've got to practice every day. And by practicing, you often don't have anything particular to say when you sit down to write each day. You're only writing just for the pleasure of handling words, and or sometimes just the pleasure of handling a pen. But if you bring your mind to bear on the very minor events of the day, or things that you've seen or heard, conversations you've overheard, and if you practice getting those into readable form, that's how it becomes less necessary to sort of waffle. You're not, because you're writing just for pleasure, and it's not about self-expression or any of those waffly ideas either. It's really just a matter of practicing handling the language. It's like practicing an instrument if you're a musician, or keeping your tools sharpened. You've got to use them on something. And to use them on the material world, you after many years of daily practice of doing that, you actually build up competence, I think, yeah.
The spare room, I mean, the title is very wonderful, and, you know, the spareness, and the word spare is an interesting word. It's sort of the extra room, but it's also about simplicity, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah, and there not and being much there. Mm.
But, you know, the prose is very spare as well. There's not a lot of filigree going on.
No, there isn't.
Which
there isn't.
I like, which is direct,
yeah.
Which goes to the heart of things.
Yeah, well, I did a hell of a lot of slashing and cutting. And there were points writing this book where I knew that I was completely on the wrong track, and every day I'd go to my office and start, and I'd know that even though what was on the paper sort of looked all right and seemed all right and it read all right, that it was going nowhere. I think that often happens when people are writing novels. I guess I'd forgotten that too, because it was so long since I'd written one.
How do you know you're on the wrong track? And where do you think you ought to be? How does it feel?
Well, there's just a feeling of that the gears aren't engaging. I mean, there's a sort of a whizzing sound, but there's no forward motion. Yeah, I think that's what it is. And see, often in a novel, you don't know where you're going, and that's the kind of thrill of it, which I'd forgotten over all these years of writing nonfiction. That when you're writing a novel, you don't even know what the material is that you're working with. Sometimes you just kind of throw yourself into a dark place and start flailing about. And so you're working enormously on instinct. And you read about people throwing away whole books that they might get right to the end of a draft of something and realise it's crap, and they throw it away. But it always interests me that people can have worked that long against this feeling that they must have had, that they were barking up the wrong tree, that they could go on for 140,000 words pushing against that resistance and not listening to that little voice that's saying, hey, go back. You know, you took the wrong turn about 40,000 words back there and you're wasting your time.
So when that happens to you, when you get that, I'm on the wrong track, what makes you go on the right track? Or do you have to leave it for a while, or do you have to...
Yeah, you have to leave it for a while. I mean, you just go and walk around miserably for a couple of days and read something, or just ride your bike around, or just go and dig in the garden.
So when you say you didn't know where it was going, a woman comes to stay for 3 weeks and she's really, you know, going through these terrible treatments and she's in a terrible pain. Mm. And Helen says, you know, she goes, you know, I'll kill anyone who hurts you. She sort of, she goes up in the lift to this theatre institute that first time and she's sort of suspecting what's going, you know, she wasn't sure what's going to happen. But she's acting out of, you know, fierce love for her friend. But how come you didn't know where it was going?
Well, how can I answer that? I knew that Nicola was going to die. I knew she was going to die, but I didn't know how. Where the point in writing, I knew that in order to keep the thing kind of racing forward as I wanted it to, I'd have to contain it in within the 3 week time factor. And of course, Nicola leaves Helen's house still alive, because actually Helen kind of can't hack it any longer, and she sends her back to Sydney. But I knew that Nicola's death had to be in the novel, and yet I had to contain it in 3 weeks. Mm. So I didn't know how I was going to get from Nicola's departure from Helen's house to the actual death in the hospice, yeah. And that was where I tried it this way and I tried it that way, and that was, I knew it was wrong, and I had. What was on the paper was all right. You know, I'd be sitting there and I'd write and I'd think, yeah, I think this might be all right. And then I'd read it over and I'd think, it's wrong. I don't know what's wrong with it, but it's not right. And then one day, in my despair, I went to the toilet and I was kind of miserably washing my hands and walking back, and I suddenly saw how I could do it. I saw that I could write a flash forward, and that I could sort of tuck that flash forward into the sort of pocket of the 3 week section, as it were, and or stitch it in there. And I rushed back and I just banged it out. It took me a couple of hours to write that last section. And I'm a really slow worker.
Yeah.
And I just bashed and crashed until it was done, and then I threw myself on the floor and I howled. And I howled for ages and I sobbed and wept and
Relief?
No, or? Just with this enormous rush of emotion came over me, and I know that it was partly because, in retrospect, I could see that my inability to write that last section was a huge resistance against describing the death. Mm. Even though I'd actually set out to write a book about someone dying, I still dug my toes in and I wouldn't go to it, and I would do anything except approach it. And somehow it was as if I had to think, sort of nut out a structural way of doing it before I could dare to approach it.
On the book show, I'm speaking with Helen Garner about her novel The Spare Room, Ramona Koval here on ABC Radio National. That's interesting you say that, although, because before that, fairly early in the book, and maybe this was written after in one of the other drafts, but Helen says death will not be denied. Mm. To try is grandiose. I just can't read my writing. It drives madness into the soul. It leeches out virtue. It injects poison into friendship and makes a mockery of love. And it's there. You wrote that.
Yep.
But somehow, it didn't become part of your understanding until you were on the floor crying?
It doesn't matter how intellectually you accept death. You can say, oh, yes, I know that I'm going to die, and I know that my friend is going to die because she's got cancer, and you sort of think, geez, I'm so cool because I have accepted death. But when it comes to the crunch, nobody wants to die, and people will do anything to avoid being near it or sort of... See, one thing that's happened since this book came out is that I did two interviews that were published in the Australian Colour magazine, and all three actually, one in The Age and one in the Sydney Morning Herald. And there was this sort of obsession that people had with whether this book was fact or fiction. And it seemed to me such a... people seemed to have this crazy obsession with kind of pinning me against the wall to find out if these things were based on real stories or had I got the right to call it a novel. And occurred to me, well, actually occurred to someone else who pointed this out to me, that this is another way of avoiding getting close to what the book's about, death. Which, let's not talk about the death stuff. Let's just talk about the mode in which it's written. And we can make a lot of clatter and noise over here, and the death part can just stay over there in the dark and we won't have to worry about it. But even intellectually grasping that doesn't help, because the fact of that we're all going to die is just sort of intolerable on some terribly profound and unreachable level.
And certainly it's intolerable for Nicola, because she just will not kind of accept to Helen's satisfaction what's actually going on here. Mm. I mean, she's having sort of rigors at night, she's sweating, she's in terrible pain. The clinic she's in doesn't seem to care about the pain and says it's part of the cure, which is horrendous. And Helen wants Nicola, she's desperate for Nicola to admit it, or saying, look, let's all admit it, we'll all help you. And so part of the strand is, you know, what right does Helen have to impose her view about what's happening on Nicola, even though it is what's happening? And in a sense, Nicola, at one point, I wonder whether she's saying she can't die, she can't, because she hasn't lived.
Yes, I don't think that's exactly what she's trying to say.
Because she hasn't had a marriage and children, and she's not really, she hasn't begun to live, in a sense.
Yeah.
Is that what she's saying?
Yes, I think that's what she's saying. Yes, she's saying that. She's, in the book there's a very minor character who's a palliative care nurse who Helen wants somebody to come to the house, she wants to get them on the books of the palliative care people so that if there's trouble at night, because the nights are terrible with when someone's in pain, that they might be able to call for help, and the district nurse would come to the house. But Nicola won't even be in that. Mm. She refuses the truth of her situation that she won't even agree to that. But after Nicola has refused a visit from the palliative people, Helen has a conversation with the palliative nurse on the telephone, and the palliative nurse, of course, is seen who knows way more about death than Helen ever will, or other people's deaths anyway, and she very patiently and quietly and unreproachfully says to Helen, well, look, there are people who cannot ever, will not ever acknowledge that they're dying, and right up to their last moment they refuse to acknowledge it. Mm. And she said, and this is one way of doing it, she says quietly and gently. But, you know, there's another aspect to this, which is that when somebody's dying, they're not the only person in the room. That's the struggle, I think, that there's an enormous, can be, an enormously domineering thing that happens, that a dying person, particularly one who's refusing to acknowledge it, can wield an enormous power over the people that are caring for them. And I have seen that happen, and I've experienced it, and it's a feeling of enormous rage. It's terrifying. I think it's particularly terrifying to people who, for whom not to tell the truth is to be in bad faith.
Mm.
There might be people who, I mean, the Helen in this book and me, myself, tend to have a rather puritanical, or shall we say, fundamentalist belief in the efficacy of facing facts, or of telling the truth as one sees it.
Does it feel funny for you to be saying Helen?
No.
Why did you call her Helen?
Well, particularly for this reason that I'm trying to articulate now, which is that I have looked after several dying people, one in particular, and I was horrified by the feelings that I had in that situation. I thought that I would be tender and patient and competent, and that I would, my feelings would all be, you know, sort of glowing ones of generosity. But in actual fact, I found that the situation plumbed the depths of me in ways that turned up some very ugly stuff, some kind of muck from the far corners of my psyche. And I was horrified and shamed by many of those feelings. And the whole time I was writing this book, I was thinking, geez, I'm going to come out of this looking really bad. It was frightening to think of those feelings of intense rage and even a kind of bullying. But so I thought, well, okay, this is a novel. I've taken enormous numbers of liberties with it. But there's one thing I do want to own as mine, and that is those feelings. I particularly thought that I wanted to sort of put them out there and see if other people had felt them, I suppose. And I think some people have.
Yeah, of course they have. Of course they have. And, you know, it is, there are some, you know, as always, you are always very brave about what you decide to talk about and the way you decide to talk about it. You're the kid who says it in the class, who says, you know, but what about that? And we're all thinking about that, and why don't we talk about it? And, you know, people often find that, as you say, difficult.
Mm.
You know, I mean, this Helen basically says, so far and no further. You know, I imagine myself as the kind of person who plumps pillows and makes a beautiful bed. But actually, if you want more than the 3 weeks that we've bargained for, I can't do it, you know, and you've got to go. And that's a really tough thing for everybody. And as always, you've made art out of these feelings, these ideas, and you've done it in this small book.
Helen, it's small because I cut off all the sentimental bits.
Oh, really?
Why? Well, you know, that's another way of dodging.
In our last minute.
that's another way of dodging the terror of death and its kind of brutal reality is to go soft and blurry and to put Vaseline on the lens and smooth it over. I worked very hard at making it just as tough as I could and not sparing the narrator and not sparing the dying person either. I wanted it to be right out there.
And that struggle of wills is so wonderful. And that sort of the question about, you know, anger. Helen says, I had always thought that sorrow was the most exhausting of the emotions. Now I know it was anger. It's a meditation on anger. It's a meditation on many things. And it's called The Spare Room, and it's published by Text. And Helen Garner, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Now, on the book show tomorrow, American short story writer Leonard Michels said in his writing that, and I quote, idea and sound had to be exactly the same length or the same destiny as if a world could be flesh, a word could be flesh. And we know he said this because a lost interview with him was unearthed in the bowels of the Paris Review archives recently. Editor Philip Gurevich will talk about this find as well as a little bit about Tim Winton's new novel, which has got a little section in the new Paris Review, and an interview with Kazuo Ishiguro. And we're going to talk about his writing life. So that's on the book show tomorrow. And screenwriter, director and novelist Paul Auster talks about his affection for human follies and the inner life of the writer. So that'll be on the book show tomorrow after 10 o'clock. Remember, you can hear this program again tonight at midnight. Or go to the website, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow is the address where you can download the program as a podcast. You can listen wherever and whenever and however many times you like. And you can find today's guest and book details there too. You can send us an email as well. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National, shortly, news time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.